vintage, retro, groovy. These are things I've heard said about the 1970s, but I don't think I've heard anyone say, it was the golden age of computer graphic images. I was working on rendering the beam. Or, would you like to see my portfolio of sprite art? No, and still no, not so much. If some of these terms seem alien, like the beam and sprite art, it was new to me too. And we dig into it as we uncover the early art of video games. Teams of artists have been working on video games since at least the early days of Atari. In fact, Atari relied on what was called a bridge to the imagination, and based on the leap from cover art to on-screen game, it sounds like they had a little too much pixie dust. Oh wait, wrong California company. Atari had the vision to use traditionally rendered artwork on their video game box art and on their arcade games cabinets, rather than the chunky sprite art that appeared in the game. The technology just wasn't there to support the in-game art in the 70s, so you'd see this amazing art on the cover of the cartridge box and label of the cartridge, and when you plugged it into play, that bridge to the imagination may or may not make it. I'm just wondering if anyone thought it was a bait and switch. Or was it what John Carmack calls technical wizardry? The how do they do it is like the man behind the curtain in The Wizard of Oz. I mean, the art is really different. I get that they were trying to get you excited about the concept of the game. I have also heard if the game art stopped you in your tracks, you may have been missing the point, and that maybe these games weren't for you. Ouch. I'll take a stab at describing what the difference is, box art versus on screen. If you haven't found us on Instagram at Whispering Gallery Podcast, I hope you'll look for us. I've posted some examples, and mind the gap. It's pretty different. I was surprised to see just how different it was with the Superman Atari 2600 game. Superman of DC Comics is familiar to all of us with the box art. He has the classic comic book look of the chiseled, muscle-bound superhero inked against a black sky with presumably planets behind him. He is shown in two poses. One shows an explosion he's flying away from. Black hair, S on his chest, yellow belt, red unders, blue tights, and red boots. The other aspect shows him standing strong in the background, hands on his hips, black hair, yellow belt, skin tone, and shadows inked. The Superman 3D inked font at the top, strong, vibrant, red, blue, yellow, and black. So let's take a look at the Superman game. Superman is rendered in large, boxy blocks, way bigger than pixels. The skyline of the city is blocky and one color, a gray silhouette in the background against a pale blue sky. The bad guy is floating on the bottom of the screen, holding a gun. Superman is in flight. His head is a square of pink, and his cape is pink, made of two lines that flap in the wind, up and down. There is a line of rust color below the cape at the neckline, then solid blue down to his feet. His body is roughly the shape of a chevron. His feet are a rust-colored box. It is pretty easy to see that rectangles are used all over the place, meaning sprites. Ray's portfolio on Instagram commented on the two Superman images. He said, "I loved this game back in the day. As a kid playing this, I had no idea what was going on. I can still hear the sound of him flying." That was on June 28th, 2021. Different types of computer graphics, CG, were in development in different environments. On one hand, Atari was dishing up sprites to TV screens on a beam, and on the other, Well, meet computer graphics researcher Martin Newell, who was working on his PhD at the University of Utah, located in the foothills of Salt Lake City, Utah, and just east of the Pi Pizzeria, a basement-level restaurant that's a really great pizzeria. If you're in town, check it out. One day, Martin was having tea with his wife and was looking for an object he could use to create a 3D mathematical test model with. Martin's wife suggested the teapot they were using, a German-made Friesland Porzellan Haushaltsteekannen household teapot. The idea was perfect. He sketched the teapot on graph paper, adding his notes for the 3D geometry. This is noted on Instagram as well, and you can see his original sketch. Back at the computer lab, using a Tektronix storage tube, aka CRT or cathode ray tube, that holds images for as long as there is power going to the tube, Martin worked on the Bezier control points, and in the end, the 3D image known as the Utah Teapot was created. It was 1975. Now comes a fun unexpected turn. In 2017, Friesland Porzellan learned about the fame of the teapot in the history of computer graphics, where the 3D test model is now a foundational image. They renamed the actual physical teapot to Utah Teapot, and is still for sale today online. For everyone who is looking for the original Utah teapot, this 1.4L pot is the right answer, is how they put it. Welcome to the Whispering Gallery. I'm Suzanne Nicolaisen, and I'm super happy to have you join me to go in search of the Phantom of the Arcade in this special two-parter about early video game art, ending with the myth of the Polybius arcade game. If you're a first-time listener, I'm glad you're here. Here at the Whispering Gallery, I tell spooky and strange stories about art and art history. If you're already a listener, welcome back to our small community of spooky art fans. So what happy mystery is leading us into the shadowy world of art secrets today? We're tracking early era video game art from the mid-1900s to the time of legend. Which time of legend? Stay tuned, and together we'll follow the path of jingling quarters into the video game arcades in search of the Polybius coin-op arcade game, and the happy homes with Atari 2600s, and handfuls of game cartridges, all from decades past. And guess what? There's more art involved than you or I might have guessed. As Pac-Man races through his mazes, being chased by colorful ghosts, we're winding our way through the intricate maze of video game art as it was being developed, in the primordial soup of digital ideas and creativity. We're not just talking Pong here, but I won't kid you, it's part of the video game art story. For simplicity, I'll be talking mainly about the Atari Coin-Op and Home Console Video Computer System, VCS, also known as the Atari 2600, and the related box cover art and video game art for the cartridges. Atari was the leader in the video game industry, but companies like Namco, Nintendo, Activision, Intellivision, Cinematronics Arcade, Imagic, Keys Game Arcade, and Commodore were busy working in the industry as well. One thing that stands out about Atari was that they didn't give their engineers, artists, and programmers any credit for working on the games. But we'll be talking about them with a little help from the book Art of Atari by Tim Lapatino. It's a book I highly recommend. It's really well done. And as Pac-Man says, quote, "Everybody believes in innovation until they see it. Then they think, oh no, that'll never work. It's too different." Unquote. by Nolan Bushnell. The mystery begins well before we start on our search for the Phantom of the Polybius arcade game. The 70s was a time for kids on pedal bikes with banana seats, Bonnie Bell lip smackers, moon boots, and feathered hair. Commercial artists were coming to the end of the cut-and-paste and overhead projector era, but technology was not entirely there yet for them to begin working on computers. Back in 1966, Ralph Baer, who has been called the father of home gaming, wrote a paper outlining the interaction between the game and the TV set. Jump to May of 1972, and Magnavox released the Odyssey game console. Skip ahead to November of the same year, and Nolan Bushnell was thinking about what he would do differently if he did a game like that. And in November of 1972, with Al Alcorn working on it, Pong was released and successful. It was said they had a gentleman's disagreement over it, but really, guys, it was more than a gentleman's disagreement. The first video game patent number 3,728,480 was granted to Ralph Baer and Sanders Associates, his employer. This was in 1973, which covered products working with domestic TV with the ability to control dots on the screen. As reported in the New York Times, Magnavox licensed their system and sold it as the Odyssey Home video game console starting in May of 1972. Can you feel the pending lawsuit brewing? In November of 1972, Pong was released by Atari, which Sanders Associates and Magnavox felt was an infringement. In 1974, they sued Atari, and Atari settled by paying $1.5 million, becoming a second licensee on Odyssey. This wasn't the only lawsuit Magnavox went after, but that's a whole other story. Al Alcorn was able to get the Pong game rolling, but not as a home product at first, but as a prototype of an arcade game cabinet. Be a flying ace, a race car champion, a tennis star, and a space pioneer, all in one afternoon. That's the Atari 2600 catalog. Atari was known as innovative leisure. Interesting combo of words. Sounds like we're floating around on a space station looking for something fun to do. Stepping back from the patents, lawsuits, there's another precision-cut facet in the story of Pong that came even before the gentleman's disagreement, aka taking Atari to court, and the game before Pong, before Odyssey, was called Tennis for Two, and was developed at Brookhaven National Laboratory in 1958. By American physicist William Higginbotham. He used a Dumont Lab oscilloscope type 304-A. William and Robert Dvorak then built the game in 3 weeks for an annual public exhibition at the laboratory. The screen of the oscilloscope displays a side view of a tennis court. The game is played with custom-built aluminum controllers that allow players to change the angle of their server with the knob on the controller, and launch the tennis ball by pressing a button on the controller. An oscilloscope screen display is used to show voltage variation. Y-axis, horizontal, shows voltage measurement, and X-axis shows time. Talk about technical tennis wizardry, voila! Game and first set go to Brookhaven National Laboratory. I can't skate by that Higginbotham was on the team that developed the first nuclear bomb. And that said, he became involved in the non-proliferation of them. Could Tennis for Two have been the first video game? Maybe. Not everyone has an oscilloscope laying around the house. Or maybe it was the Nimitron that was shared at the New York World Fair in 1940, but that might really be stretching it with no display screen. Tennis for Two on the oscilloscope, the Pong father, Nolan Bushnell's lift of Odyssey on Magnavox, this has nothing if not the makings of a great opera. The story of Atari's business has all the makings of one: community, borrowed intellectual property, redesign of technology chips, company sold to Big Entertainment, Warner Brothers, and hostile or aggressive push-out of Nolan. Tanking company redirect to blame one programmer and a game for the entire woes. And after years gone by, a reemergence in a non-glorious branding effort. My husband and I met a guy wearing an Atari shirt, and when my husband asked him what his favorite game was, he answered that he was just a poser. If you know the name Atari, you probably know one or two of the game names. So that was a really interesting answer. We're talking mainly about the Atari home consoles, but have you or your parents visited the arcade, going to the mall to hang out, explore the strange stuff for sale at the Spencer's, like fiber optic lamps with color-changing light, or maybe sip on a creamy orange Julius and snack on cheese popcorn? But entering the arcade to its electronic twilight, wandering around, the game sound effects layering over game music and people talking. Quarters lined up on the screen of the arcade games. Let's run through a timeline before Polybius supposedly showed up in the arcade. 1958, Tennis for Two was developed from Brookhaven Laboratories. 1962, Space War was developed at MIT. Magnavox Odyssey was released in May of 1972. Atari's Pong was released in November of 1972, the arcade version. Steve Jobs was hired by Atari in 1974 as a technician to assist the engineers. And the thing is, he was having Steve Wozniak, the Woz, work on the engineering while Woz was also working at HP. Later on, Atari offered Steve Wozniak a job, but he decided to stay at HP. 1975 is when Atari partnered with Sears for Pong for consoles. 1975, Martin Newell modeled the 3D computer graphic known as the Utah Teapot. This is heading in two different directions of computer graphics, with Pong and sprites and the beam displaying things, and the 3D model of the computer graphic known as the Utah Teapot is a kind of a whole other ball game of 3D rendering, modeling the image digitally. In 1977, Nintendo had Color TV game, 15 variations of Pong. The crash of 77, the market was flooded with Pong and there was consumer fatigue.
Your life force is running out.
In 1977, Atari 2600, 128 colors and 450 plus games. The Atari 2600 displayed approximately 30,720 pixels at 192 by 160. 1979, Space Invaders, first time licensed to the Space Invaders name. Reddit said an invader house was the name given to urban centers, amusement spaces in Japan where cocktail table Space Invaders cabinets were installed, circa 1979. Asteroids was Atari's biggest game, which was done in Vector, and in 1980, Intellivision was out with 16 colors. I have a quote from Ernest Cline from Ready Player One, quote, "There, inside the game's two-dimensional universe, life was simple. It's just you against the machine. Move with your left hand, shoot with your right, and try to stay alive as long as possible." Unquote. Looking at box artwork was often a game player's first exposure to a new game title. Then you buy it, take it home, and cross the imagination bridge. But there's a toll on that there bridge. Plug the cartridge into the console and take the leap from the beautiful, traditionally rendered box art to the clunky rectangles of sprites. Still, video game companies were starting to pop up like so many mushrooms in Mario Brothers. Atari didn't recognize their programmers or artists, and I don't know if this was a break from conventional entertainment giving credit to the creative people working on the projects, or if it was more of a, when you have a marketing team and you have graphic artists creating content or new art, they aren't generally credited with the artwork for the images in marketing. So I'm not sure if that's the way they were leaning. Maybe they were worried about their talent being searched out. So there were different things going on to make the magic of the game happen. The art on the screen was drawn one line at a time. The microprocessor rewrites the screen all the way down the screen in a big hurry. The computer only had a line buffer. One line was the buffer for the screen. Constantly had to draw a line, get the next line out of the buffer. The microprocessor was pushing the next line out. The main processor was writing to the HCIP, keeping track of when to stop displaying something and start writing graphics. The video chip, TIA, Television Interface Adapter, codename Stella, was designed at Grass Valley. Atari made their own chip, so it would be harder to steal it and to relieve the burden on 6502. It could keep track of five objects and keep track of things moving horizontally. There was a rumor that Stella was the name of a woman, but it actually was the name of the TIA designer's road bike, a French bicycle manufacturer. Sprite, pixel, vector, raster, bitmap. Have you ever wondered about any of these? I have a quote from The Art of Atari by Tim Lepetino, the foreword written by Ernest Klein. Quote, "The box artwork was an essential part of the ritual of escape you experienced each time you played an Atari game. In a player's mind, the artwork on the label would be forever linked to the digital artifact inside." Unquote. The font that was used by Atari typefaces for the 2600 carts and packages were Harry and Bauhaus. Now, a sprite that I've been mentioning, a rectangle, from Wikipedia, they state a 2D bitmap integrated into a larger scene. Sprites referred to a fixed-sized objects composited together by hardware with a background. Again, that came from Wikipedia. So these sprites floated over the top of a bitmap, a smaller shape that they could move around, with low software overhead. Let's talk about VDP sprites for a minute. In H32 mode, each line can display 256 pixels, and that would be 16 sprites at the most per scan line. Now, in H40 mode, you would get 320 pixels, giving you 80 sprites, and whatever gets displayed is highest priority, which you would think whatever you're putting there is a high priority, but I'm sure the programmers know what the deal is with this. Texas Instruments first used Video Display Processor, VDP, by Danny Hillis. The sprite was a smaller 2D bitmap that moved around a larger screen. Okay, so that's sprites. Pixels, you may have heard about because we still use them. These are squares. I'm quoting again from Wikipedia. It is the smallest controllable element of a picture represented on the screen. In 2010, Kirsch told the Oregonian, quote, "Squares was the logical thing to do. Of course, the logical thing was not the only possibility, but we used squares. It was something very foolish that everyone in the world has been suffering from ever since." Unquote. He seems like he's being a little hard on himself. Okay, we'll go on to Vector 3D. This is the first step to the immersive environment. Vector artwork is created based on math using points, lines, shapes, and curves. There is no resolution problem because they can be scaled as needed. This is great for graphic design. So if you need to make something for the web that's smaller, or something for a billboard, you can resize your vector image. Ivan Sutherland of Evans & Sutherland, founded in Salt Lake City in 1968, used vector in Sketchpad. That was around 1963. Vector graphic files extensions include SVG, WMF, EPS, PDF, CDR, and AI. So hopefully one or two of those was familiar to you that you've run across, like EPS or SVG, if you've been working in Illustrator. I have another quote from Nolan Bushnell. "I always loved both Breakout and Asteroids. I thought they were really good games. There was another game called Tempest that I thought was really cool, and it represented a really hard technology. It's probably one of the only color vector screens that was used in the computer graphics field at that time." Unquote, Nolan Bushnell. Raster is also known as bitmaps. It's made up of pixels of colors. If you scale a raster image, you end up getting pixelization, or the jagged artifacts. It just doesn't look good. That's what Kirsch was talking about to the Oregonian, that everyone has been suffering about, is that pixelization or jagged look. File formats for raster include JPEG, PNG, APNG, GIF, WebP, BMP, and MPEG-4. MPEG-4 and bitmap. Late in the 60s, Michael Knoll created a scan display with raster graphics, Bell Labs. Evelyn Cito, graphic design manager, is quoted in The Art of Atari on page 24 as saying, quote, "Atari was unique. At that time, very few companies had internal artists, but we had so much work to do that we had a staff inside, and we still had to hire some of it out." Unquote. Another of the graphic areas to cover is TV screens. Television screens in the 70s and 80s were cathode ray tube, CRT, where electrons are fired at glass that is coated in phosphors, which in turn glow, creating something you can see. The screen wasn't displayed all at once, but was produced, or rather, what they call drawn, line by line. The screen was the result of scan lines drawn individually. Here's another quote, this one from Racing the Beam. Quote, "The scanning finger of the TV screen is at once transcending of mechanism and a throwback to the world of the scribe." Unquote. That was Marshall McLuhan in Racing the Beam, the Atari Video Computer System by Nick Montfort and Ian Bogost. From the point of view of the Atari 2600 or VCS and or Atari programmer, the picture on the TV is horizontal lines, not pixels. Sprites are the best resolution you can get out of a TIA. The smallest bit of horizontal space is called a color clock. Atari was big on great box art. It helped connect the gamer to the game. Fully rendered images on the box to the sprites and the game screen not so polished. Check out the Whispering Gallery podcast Instagram feed to see some examples of box art with the in-game on-screen graphics.
Use the box loop.
It seems like cartridges were being developed as fast as Donkey Kong could roll out barrels. The money was in cartridges and not the systems. I'm going to pull the book out and we're going to talk about three different video game stories that came up, shared by The Art of Atari. I've actually seen a movie about the E.T. story. Okay, so they were blaming a big fail of one game being the scapegoat or the fall guy for the entire fall of Atari, so to speak. I'm going to quote from page 152 of The Art of Atari. E.T. the Extraterrestrial. "The legend that has grown up around Atari's licensed E.T. title nearly eclipses the actual game itself, which is a shame. Underneath landfill burials and labels of worst video game ever is an imaginative adventure title that pushed the boundaries of the 2600. Programmed by Howard Scott Warshaw in a ridiculously short 6 weeks, The game sends E.T. searching for three parts of his communications device needed phone home. While attempting to rendezvous with his spaceship, E.T. can gather candy pieces, Reese's pieces, get help from Elliot, and avoid both a menacing FBI agent and a meddlesome scientist. The game does have collision detection issues, getting in and out of pits, and the instruction manual is required reading. But in all, E.T. is an enjoyable game and welcome part of the 2600 library. Continuing on page 154 in the section E.T. Unearthing a Mystery, quote, "It's one of the most enduring myths of video game history, one of those stories that spread virally even before the advent of the internet. But there is a nugget of truth wrapped up amidst the tall tales, exaggerations, and downright misinformation. The legend sounds something like this. Myth. In the fall of 1983, Atari buried millions of E.T. game cartridges in a southwestern desert landfill. Embarrassed by poor sales and critical reception of its licensed 2600 game, E.T., the extraterrestrial, based on the hit Steven Spielberg film, Atari decided to hide its failure, the supposed worst video game ever, entombing it in Alamogordo, New Mexico. That game was reportedly so terrible that it sent shockwaves through the industry, causing the video game market crash of 1983, which led to the rapid downfall of Atari. Very few of those conclusions are true, but nonetheless, many of the mythical elements have endured, spawning legends and vast tapestries of internet comment threads over the years." The following is a recording of the Atari Game Over trailer, posted to YouTube by Q Media Box Office.
"Under that landfill is a burial site of an entire industry.
Growing up, you always read little rumors about it.
The dreams of a generation buried underneath the garbage. You can hear it screaming or something, I don't know.
Billions of cartridges out in the desert.
Worst video game ever. E.T. for Atari.
It was bad.
Brutal, unfair, didn't make a lot of sense.
How did a company that was so innovative fail so miserably?
This is a company that made $375 million. The fastest growing company in American history.
That was super exciting to be the pioneers in that field. It just blew people away. This was what I was made to do. The word hubris comes to mind.
If the quotas were met, I'd throw a kegger.
Over there is where the hot tub was.
These guys are the lifeblood of the business. They do what they want to do.
Engineers as rock stars.
E.T. comes out. It's a huge hit, and we want to do the cartridge.
There'll be a Learjet waiting for you. Be ready to propose the game to Spielberg.
It was $20 to $30 million. It was some crazy number. We had to have the game out for Christmas.
Typical VCS game took 5 or 6 months, and this was going to be in 5 weeks. Yeah, I can do that.
Everybody I knew got E.T. that Christmas.
People aren't liking it.
One of the worst nights of my life.
The train is derailing. I could be single-handedly responsible for toppling a $1 billion industry.
Useless, worthless product. How do you get rid of it?
You said you wanted to know where the Ataris are.
Wait, this is the spot?
The concern is they also may have something else buried in the landfill.
We might crack open a sealed tomb of mercury-laced pigs.
What's the last time you saw a line of people waiting to get into a dump?
They want some kind of tangible evidence.
It's like opening the Ark of the Covenant.
The burial in Alamogordo is Atari's funeral.
This has sort of felt like a religious pilgrimage to me.
Is my face going to melt off? I don't know. E.T. comes out, the industry dies. That's what people will remember him for.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Searching for the Phantom of the Arcade. It's been super interesting learning all about the older graphic formats and this last story about E.T., I do recommend looking up the movie and watching it. It was really interesting. And to have some of those myths debunked and how one programmer had it totally on his shoulders for the Atari company failing seems pretty ridiculous. Thank you for being with me this time. There's more to come. And if you've heard little dogs in the background, that would have been Shotzi or Boomer. And we'll have a studio dog update in one of the next episodes of this series. So until then, stay safe and take care and keep your spooky art stories close. I'll talk to you soon.